So we're actually going to pick up the story back in chapter 8, just so we catch the flow, and then get into chapter 9, which is the story of Abimelech, who was actually Gideon's son. So in chapter 8, verse 28, it says, "Thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel, so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon." So what a blessing to have 40 years of peace. Maybe what we ought to do, no, we would never be able to, I was going to make a political statement where we have the president, you know, have a term of 40 years so that every 4 years we don't go all through this wrangling all over again, but that wouldn't be good either, would it? So anyway, Gideon was able to be used by God to bring peace to the people for 40 years. Verse 29, "Then Jerubbaal," which is Gideon's other name, "the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house." Well, where was his own house? Does anybody remember from before where he lived, where he grew up? He was up in the Jezreel Valley in a place called Ophrah, not Oprah, although it's close. Ophrah, O-P-H-R-A-H, up in the northern part of the country in the Jezreel Valley. But it seems that he must have traveled around a bit as a judge through all of the tribes, because he had a concubine in the town of Shechem farther south, which is in the tribal allotment of Ephraim or Manasseh. It's a border town between Ephraim and Manasseh, and a lot of the maps will show it actually in Manasseh. Shechem is the modern town of Nablus, one of the West Point, I got that in my head now, West Bank territories, a largely Arab town within Israel, Nablus, about 30 or 40 miles north of Jerusalem. And so there's a majority Arab population there today and a very small Christian community in Nablus, which is the name for modern, for ancient Shechem. So he went to his own home back up in the Jezreel Valley, and it says in verse 30 that Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. With 70 sons, I'm glad it were many wives instead of just one. That would be a remarkable thing. But he had many wives and 70 sons. What a family. And verse 31 says, "His concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son whose name he called Abimelech." And so we're going to be talking mostly about Abimelech today. And unfortunately, the tumult that arose as a result of his ambition, his selfish ambition, and inspiring actually a civil war in Israel as a result of that. So he's the theme of chapter 9. He's the son of one of Gideon's concubines in Shechem. Now, Abimelech is a name that comes from two Hebrew words, Abi or Abba, which some of you will recognize, which means daddy or father, and Melech is the Hebrew word for king. And so Abimelech was my father the king, or my father is king, or father king, if you just put them together like that. That's what his name means. Now, the interesting thing is that Gideon had renounced his title as king. The people wanted to make Gideon a king after he succeeded in routing the Midianites, and he refused. Back in chapter 8, verse 22, it says, "The men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.' But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" And he was adamant about that, which is certainly to his credit. He recognized God's sovereignty over the people. He wasn't going to insert himself in that place. And it reminded me in reading that as I mentioned, I think earlier, George Washington also refused the title of king when we had defeated the British in the Revolutionary War. People said, now what kind of a leader should we have? What should we call him? There were debates, and people wanted to make George Washington king. And he said, no, I'm not going to be a king. And they ultimately decided on the presidency, of course. But Washington was a humble man like that. And we see that Gideon had the same attitude. They tried to make him king. It would have been very easy for him to have accepted, falling into the human nature, the pride, the honor of men. But he said, no, that wouldn't be the right thing. and he kept people's eyes focused on God, and he simply judged the people. He still judged for many years. And I think largely because of who he was, I think that lent probably to the peace that Israel had for all of those years. So it's kind of interesting here that Abimelech, his name means my father king, and Gideon wasn't a king. He had refused that and pointed out the fact that God actually was their king. Now, when you realize what the people were desiring to do with Gideon, they wanted to make him the king and his son after him the king. If you're a son and your dad says, no, I'm not going to be the king, what does that mean for the sons too? He got shunted a little bit. And so here he's got 70 sons. Somebody's going to get his nose bent out of shape. And it turns out that we find that the son of this concubine is one who perhaps felt a little left out and felt that that was his due, and he sought the kingship of Israel. And it led to a civil war, as we'll see. So the name is a little ironic here. Father in the name is actually used not necessarily towards Gideon, but euphemistically for God. So we'll see that Abimelech really wasn't well-named in any respect, because he didn't follow God as his father, and his father Gideon wasn't a king. So it's all ironic there. Picking it up again in verse 32, it says, now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. Again, that's up in the Jezreel Valley. And so it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal-berith their god. Didn't take long. As soon as the stopper takes his finger out of the dike, all the water starts flowing towards paganism again. It's just an amazing thing that Gideon led them effectively, and as soon as he was out of the scene, then the people started to revert again to this false worship. Now, the chapter that we're going to get into tonight actually explains how an abomination came about. And this is a little bit of foreshadowing. Let's continue. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Lord their God, who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, to Gideon, in accordance with the good that he had done for Israel. And boy, is that an understatement. As a matter of fact, the lack of kindness that was shown toward the house of Gideon came, ironically enough, from his own son, Abimelech. He despised his father's household more than any other. And he's the one whose story we pick up now in chapter 9. So let's continue on. Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's brothers, and he spoke with them and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, let's stop there for a moment. His mother was a Shechemite. His father, Gideon, was from up in the Jezreel Valley. He wasn't getting any satisfaction. I mean, he was in competition, I guess you could say, with his brothers. And he was pseudo-legitimate as a son, since he was the son of a concubine rather than a wife. And so where did he go to stir up his own party? His mother's house in Shechem. Let's talk a little bit about Shechem. It was one of the cities of refuge located right basically center of the country in Israel. Hebron was farther to the south, and of course up in the north, Kadesh, and then there were three across the Jordan River on the east. But Shechem was one of the original cities of refuge that God had ordained as a place of refuge for those whose crimes, not intentional but unintentional, they could go and find shelter. And here this city was going to be no shelter for the crimes that were to be done in this place. It's right along the ridge route, and it's bordered by two hills, Mount Ebal in the north and Mount Gerizim to the south of Shechem. And I've got a picture that will show you that a little bit. Right along this route that runs along the center of the country, north and south, there's Shechem with Mount Ebal and Mount Ephraim, or Mount Gerizim, on each side. So this is what it looks like if you're looking from the Jordan side with Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. They're very substantial heights. Shechem is a prominent place in the history of the scripture. It's where God gave the promises of land to Abraham himself. Later on, Jacob settled there for a time and gave the allotment to his son Joseph. And again, Shechem is on the border territory between Ephraim and Manasseh, the sons of Joseph. And he also dug a well there that's mentioned in the book of John, the well where Jesus met the Samaritan woman at this well, at Jacob's well, which was at this location of Shechem, although it's called Sychar in the New Testament. The 12 tribes gathered after the conquest on these two hills on each side of Shechem, and that's where God had them recite, six tribes on each hill, and God had them announce blessings and cursings. Six of the tribes would announce the cursings that would befall Israel if they failed to follow God, and the other six tribes on the other hill announced the blessings that God would give if they were obedient. This is at the very outset of their inheritance into the promised land. This is where it took place. So it's kind of ironic that this place was going to become the site of a civil war because people failed to follow obediently the will of God. So there's an interesting history to this town and to the story that we have this background. Here again are some of the ruins. This wall dates back to the Middle Bronze Age, which is the time when we're talking about here during the period of the Judges. And Mount Gerizim rises in the background. You can get a little bit of a sense of the height of the hill on each side of the city. And these are some ruins from the gate that was in existence at the time of Abimelech. It was a fortified town, a protected town. And so you can go there and actually find the ruins of the gate with its three chambers that was very typical of the style of the construction at that time. Possibly in existence at the time of Jacob, but they have dated it certainly to the time of Abimelech. Also, interestingly enough, we found that the people started worshiping Baal-berith, and here in the ruins of Shechem is the largest fortified temple found in Israel. And it is dedicated, or was dedicated in those days, to Baal-berith. So there's evidence right here in the archaeological records of what we find recorded in the scripture. The walls of this were 17 feet thick. This was a very, very well-fortified structure. Excuse me. It's one of the places where people took refuge during the war. This is an aerial view, actually from Google Maps. Shechem in the middle with Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim flanking it on the sides. And somewhere out here in that territory generally is where the well was located. Here again is another view showing the two mountains flanking Shechem. And this is a picture of Jacob's well, at least as it looked in 1934. I'm sure that's nothing like what it looked like in the days of Abimelech or Jacob when he dug it. It's about 70 feet deep, largely silted up at this time. But, you know, 300 years after the time of Christ, anything that was related in any way to Christ started to become, built up. They would build chapels and things over the locations. And since there was no question that this was the location of Jacob's well where Christ spoke with the Samaritan woman, it was one of those locations that saw church after church after chapel constructed over the top of it. And so there's a huge conglomerate of different types of structures that have been built over it. It looks nothing like now what it used to, obviously. But in 1934, it was a Greek Orthodox chapel, and this is what it looked like at that time. And once again, now we're looking at Mount Ebal across Shechem from Mount Gerizim. So we're going to leave this slide up as our background for a time. But that's a little background to the location where this story is taking place. And it's the location for what is a rebellion against God. And returning again to Baal worship, it's going to result in the destruction of the city, which is actually quite ironic. Easton's Bible Dictionary gives the history of Shechem. It says, this is where Abraham pitched his tent and built his first altar in the promised land and received the first divine promise. So here it is, one of these locations where people turn to paganism. And it was the very first location where Abraham even built an altar to the true God. Here's where Jacob bought a parcel of a field from the hands of the children of Hamor. After he returned from Mesopotamia, he settled with his household. He purged the city of idolatry. And now the place goes back to idolatry. Here is where Joshua gathered all Israel before God and delivered his second parting address and made a covenant with the people that day at the very place on their first entering of the land when they responded to the law from Ebal and Gerizim, as I mentioned earlier. So all of these things that are noted as things that happened dedicated to God in the history of Israel, this is where a civil war is going to take place, where the people are going to turn to Baal and so on. It's just almost, you know, makes your heart sick when you realize that they turn their backs so badly on their history and their legacy. So he went to his mother's household, and he spoke to them. Let's go back to chapter 9 and verse 2. He said, "Please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal reign over you, or that one reign over you? Remember, I'm your own flesh and bone." So which one is he suggesting this should reign over them? I mean, Gideon's dead now. So what? People naturally would look to the children of such a great man. Should it be divvied up among all 70? I mean, isn't that confusion? Did you ever hear the story of, my son was reading to me today as we were coming up. He's got a joke book. He said three men were talking about the great professions of the Bible. And the doctor said that the first great profession recorded in the scripture was a surgeon, because God made a woman from the rib of a man. And the second one was an engineer. And he said, no, the first profession recorded in the scripture was engineering. And look at all the incredible complexity of the universe. God brought that all into being out of chaos. And the third man said, he was a politician, he said, where do you think the chaos came from? So we have chaos when there are too many people trying to rule. And 70 people wasn't going to be any good. We need one leader is what Abimelech was saying. We just need one guy. And look, I'm your guy, aren't I? I'm your flesh and blood. I'll take care of you. This is party spirit at its worst. And his mother's brothers, verse 3, spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. So he got his family behind him, and then they went out to the whole neighborhood in the streets and the highways and byways, and they started saying, their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, well, he's our brother. I mean, he's our physical brother, but he's from our town. We're the ones. He can be the leader. Oh, great. So the attitude and the motivation here of Abimelech and of the men of Shechem is what? To serve the people of Israel? Or to find exaltation? Right? This was totally self-focused. Abimelech was selfishly ambitious. He was vainglorious and probably resentful toward his father, toward his brothers, and so on. Abimelech wanted to reign. Is that what Gideon sought? Did he want to reign? He did effectively, but he was a humble man, and he ruled well. He didn't reign so much as he judged, because he said, God is the one who reigns. Abimelech wanted to reign. That was the sin of Lucifer, wasn't it? Lucifer wanted to reign in the kingdom of God, and he felt passed over. Where that attitude exists, what always happens? Where there is that attitude of desire for power and desire for authority, it's predictable what always follows. There's an old saying. It says, those who most desire power are least deserving to exercise it. Because it's selfish. And the purpose of power and authority is to serve, not to aggrandize self. Was Abimelech angry? Yeah, apparently. Like I say, he probably felt passed over or resentful. Should anybody follow such a man? With an angry man, Scripture tells us, do not go. I mean, you the scriptures just scream out with warnings against following an angry man. We should be careful about that. Proverbs 22, verse 24. Let's hold your finger here and let's read what God says. Proverbs 22, verse 24. Oops, that's Psalms. No wonder it didn't look right. There we go. Proverbs 22, verse 24. It says, make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go. Well, here was Abimelech, and he was angry, and he stirs people up, and everybody makes friendships with him. And how does he stir them up? He kind of makes them resentful and angry the same way. So now you've got angry people making friendships with other angry people. Is there any wisdom anywhere in that? It's kind of crazy, isn't it? It says, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. What's the consequence? There's no good that's going to come from this. Back in verse 3 of this chapter 22, it says, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and they're punished. If a man had prudence in Shechem, he would have seen the attitude that was there and said, I don't want any part of this. This is just wrong. And he'd have preserved himself. But the simple-minded, the ones that allow themselves to get caught up in it, they just pass on and they end up punished. Verse 5, thorns and snares are in the way of the perverse. He who guards his soul will be far from them. Thorns and snares. And that's exactly what we see is going to happen. So let's go back then to Judges chapter 9. Judges chapter 9, and we'll continue the story. We see that the people here in Shechem, fearing they want to make sure that they get what's their due, which is the same thing that Eve wanted to do in the garden. She wanted to make sure that she got her due. That's what Satan stirred up. Don't you know that if you do this, then you'll be made wise? Isn't that your due? Well, the people of Shechem were saying that, you know, we want this as well. And so it's the same thing, same attitude is there. And it's interesting when you read through here, it's a very fair-sounding approach here, you know. Avoid the confusion of 70. That's just going to be chaotic, and that's going to go nowhere. Follow me and just me. That's better for everyone. And especially it'll be better for you people here of Shechem, because after all, I'm one of you. So that you can see that there's this human logic or reasoning to it as well. Satan and his way isn't devoid of logic, but the motivations, I mean, he uses logic for wrong ends. So back in chapter 9 of Judges, verse 4, so they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith. They had turned to Baal. And of course, the temples were places where wealth accumulated. And so they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech then hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Well, you can say in one sense, who else was he going to hire? The righteous? They'd never follow him because he was doing wrong. They go to the temple of Baal. That should have been a problem in the first place. And they give him 70 shekels so that he can go out and hire riffraff in order to accomplish their purposes. I mean, there is everything about this stinks. It's sour from the outset. So he went out, and I guess you could say he hired dirtbags. Who did that later on in history of Israel? How about Jeroboam? The time when the nation divided, Jeroboam was in the north, Rehoboam was in the south. Jeroboam set up false worship, and he went out and hired the lowest of the land to be priests. You know, people he could pay off. Well, that's what Abimelech is doing. He found people he could pay off and do his bidding. Verse 5. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah, and he killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. So there was some kind of gathering that he had perhaps called together. And think about this. This is your brother. You go back home for a family gathering, and it was all a plot. He did it all so that he could assassinate his brothers. Why? They're his biggest threats, aren't they? His political enemies. So he had to eliminate them if his plot was to be successful. He got rid of them. 70 of his brothers, he killed them all. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself. So here he is, the youngest. Just like, you know, David was the youngest in his family, and he was the one that God exalted. So often we see the ones that are the least in the eyes of so many that are the ones that God ultimately will use. Jotham was able to escape this. He hid himself. God's going to use him later on. So he came and he got rid of the ones who could stand in his way. Doesn't say exactly how he did it, but he had them all killed. And all the men of Shechem, verse 6, gathered together, all of Beth Milo, and they went and they made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. This terebinth tree may be the very location where Jacob, earlier in Israel's history, had purged Shechem of the idolatry. He got rid of the teraphim and he buried them under a tree in Shechem. This might be the very same tree. And so later on, here they are, and this is where they're going to set up Israel's first king. It wasn't Saul, it was Abimelech. Isn't that interesting? Because that's what he sought. He sought the leadership. He didn't want to just be a judge. The kingship had been offered to his father, which would have left him next in line, or at least in the contention. He'd been passed over, and he wanted it, and now he got it. The people made him a king. At least the people of Shechem did. And it was right by this tree that might have been the very place where Jacob purged the city earlier of idolatry. Verse 7, now when they told Jotham, he went and he stood on top of Mount Gerizim, and he lifted his voice and he cried out. And this is the place, this is the view that very likely would have been where Jotham stood at the head of this hill, which was the Hill of Blessings. Ebal was the Hill of Curses. Gerizim was the Hill of Blessings. Jotham stands on this hill overlooking the people in the town below. And he said to them, verse 7, listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them. And so he's going to give them an extended parable here. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, what, should I cease giving my oil, with which they honor God and men, and go sway over the trees? I've got a perfectly good function here. I produce olives and olive oil. And by that production, I'm helpful. I can contribute. People are benefited from it. God and man are all benefited from this. What, you want me to leave doing what is good for all of you and everyone else, so that what, I can just kind of sway over the other trees? Isn't that indicative of what a leader does who's not leading righteously in service? He just sways over the others to get all the honor and all the pomp and all the glory. But what's he doing that's valuable and productive and good? So the olive tree says to those who are trying to make him king, what, should I give up all the good that I'm doing just so that I can sway over trees? Verse 10, then the tree said to the fig tree, well, the olive tree won't do it. You come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit to sway over trees? Again, I'm going to give up what I'm doing that's productive and good. Verse 12, then the trees said to the vine, will you come and reign over us? But the vine said to them, should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and man, and go to sway over trees? What we're seeing here is a good, humble attitude of service, not one of pride and arrogance and vanity. Then all the trees said to the bramble, we can't get anyone else to do it. You come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. And you can say, what shade does a bramble offer? Right? You got to have a huge clump of bramble impenetrably thick brambles in order to produce shade that's going to do anything. In truth, if you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, then let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. I mean, any way you do, you make a deal with the bramble or you don't make a deal with the bramble, you're going to get hurt. So this is the parable that he gives. And then he says, now therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done to him as he deserves, if you have done this, and the answer to this is already what? Well, no, they haven't done well in making Abimelech king. Their motives were all wrong. No, they hadn't done well by Gideon and his house. They'd killed all of his children. They hadn't given Gideon the honor that was his due. So the answer to this is already foregone, isn't it? If you have done rightly in your actions, verse 17, for my father fought for you, and he risked his life, and he delivered you out of the hands of Midian. But you have risen up against my father's house this day, and killed his 70 sons on one stone, and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the men of Shechem, because he's your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbaal and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, then let fire come from Abimelech and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. You're all going to burn. And so Jotham ran away and fled, and he went to Be'er and dwelt there. You know, a lot of times when you're in trouble, where do you run? To the beer. And people dwell there. And and he dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. And that's not advice, by the way. That's okay. And he dwelt there for fear of Abimelech, his brother. And then after Abimelech had reigned over Israel 3 years, imagine that. 3 years gone by, then God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. Well, is that any surprise? They dealt treacherously to get Abimelech into the position in the first place. People who do things treacherously can be expected to do things treacherously in the future. Make no friendship with an angry man. It's just foolish. A prudent man sees that and avoids it. But he needed to make friends with people who were of his same character to accomplish their mutual purpose. You know what? That only lasts as long as your purpose is mutual. If on either side things start to go south, everything falls apart. There's no character. There's no honor. And so you can't have any trust. You can't have any dependability there. So this was a predictable result. So God allowed this to happen. Now you can say, did God actually cause this division? Or did God just allow the human nature that was in them all to have its natural course? Nature played out to its logical end in this case. Had the men of Shechem demonstrated a willingness to deal treacherously before? Yes, of course they had. So you could expect that they would do so again. If you make an alliance with someone of bad character, it will bite you. It always does. What you sow will be what you reap. Cast your bread on the waters and it will come back to you. I mean, we see this principle repeatedly. It just bears logic. He who lives by the sword, we're told, will die by the sword, we're told. God is not mocked. Hold your finger here. Let's go to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. You know, living according to the righteous code that God asks of us to live doesn't always in the short term seem to make the most physical sense. Sometimes we do the right thing and we get punished for it, it seems. But you know what? We did the right thing. And so, did Christ do the right thing? Yeah, got him crucified. He's our example, he's our elder brother, and he's the one who ultimately is going to make it all right in the end, isn't it? We have to rely on that. If we don't do the right thing, and gain a short-term benefit, it won't last. We're in it for the long term, aren't we? So we have to play it by those rules. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 7 says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." Well, what happened to Abimelech? He went in and he sowed discord, he sowed upset, he sowed all this garbage, and that's what he reaped in return. If we sow the things that are of righteousness in time, that's what we will see return. We have to commit ourselves to that because sometimes, you know, it's hard to stick to the ways of righteousness. But we can have confidence of what a man sows, that he will reap. God will not be mocked. He will make it good. He always does. So let's get back to the story of Judges. In verse 20, where am I? 24? Verse 23, God sent a spirit of ill will between Abimelech and the men of Shechem, and the men of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech that the crime done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal might be settled, and their blood laid on Abimelech, their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who aided him in the killing of his brothers. So again, this is something that God had a hand in the sense that he allowed it to happen so that the natural consequence could come on those individuals. Verse 25, and the men of Shechem set men in ambush against him, that is Abimelech, on the tops of the mountains, and they robbed all who passed by them along that way, and it was told to Abimelech. So here were the Shechemites, and there was a major highway that went by Shechem, and they would ambush people along the way. And Abimelech found out about it. And now Gaal, the son of Ebed, came with his brothers, and they went over to Shechem, and the men of Shechem put their confidence in him. Just like the men of Shechem had earlier put their confidence in Abimelech, now they found a new guy named Gaal. Gaal's name means rejection or loathing. How'd you like to go to through life with a name like that? According to one biblical scholar, Wellhausen, his name means beetle. He was a beetle. We know nothing about him other than what we see recorded here in Judges chapter 9. And what he does is he foments a rebellion against Abimelech, a rebellion that ultimately fails. But he inspires a loathing against Abimelech, and guess what? His name means loathing. So he's well-named in that sense. He probably deserved the name. Verse 27. So they went out into the fields, and they gathered grapes from their vineyards, and they trod them, and they made merry. And they went into the house of their god, and ate and drank, and they cursed Abimelech, their king. You know, if you want to end up getting cursed, just become king, and sooner or later you will be. So it happened. Gaal inspired all of this, got them all drunk. They made merry. And in a drunken stupor, they started. They were sensible to Gaal's rabble. Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech, and who is Shechem that we should serve him? Aren't we the Shechemites better than Abimelech? Who is this guy? Isn't he the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor, the father of Shechem, but why should we serve him?" So his split parentage now comes back to haunt him. When he wanted the leadership, being a Shechemite through his mother was a good thing. When somebody else comes along and says, "He's really not one of us. I mean, he's of the other house." You know, things flip so quickly, so easily. And Gaal continues in verse 29, "If only this people were under my authority, then I would remove Abimelech." And so he said to Abimelech, "Increase your army and come out." And so he inspires this turning of the people of Shechem against Abimelech and basically challenges him. Gaal appears to the Shechemites' party spirit just like Abimelech had earlier. But this time he makes Abimelech the outsider instead of the insider. "You're Shechemites." He's not, though he was by his mother. It's all a matter of how you spin it. And if you can spin it convincingly enough to the people that are going to hear. And then he gets them all drunk, and he taunts Abimelech, or his reputation, this way. So there are a bunch of senseless drunks when all of this happens. Verse 30, then Zebul, the ruler of the city, who was an ally, an officer of Abimelech, when he heard the words of Gaal, the son of Ebed, then his anger was aroused. And he sent messengers to Abimelech secretly, saying, take note, Gaal, the son of Ebed, and his brothers have come to Shechem, and here they are, fortifying the city against you. Now therefore, get up by night, you and the people who are with you, and lie in wait in the field. And it shall be as soon as the sun is up in the morning that you shall rise early and rush upon the city. And when he and the people who are with him come out against you, then you may then do to them as you find opportunity. So he's, as a military officer and advisor, suggesting a strategy to Abimelech on how they can put down this rebel Gaal and those that he's stirred up. He sends word and strategy to Abimelech in this way. Verse 34, so Abimelech and all the people who were with him rose by night, and they lay in wait against Shechem in four companies. And when Gaal, the son of Ebed, went out and stood in the entrance to the city gate, then Abimelech and the people who were with him rose from lying in wait. And when Gaal saw the people, he said to Zebul, look, people are coming down from the tops of the mountains. So he was surprised. You saw those mountains in the pictures earlier. You can imagine they're all lying down low and they can't be seen in the darkness because it's dim. And then all of a sudden they start getting up and they start swarming down toward the city. And you can imagine how you must feel then. Look, there are people coming down here, but it's still dim. And so what does Zebul say back to Gaal? He says, Zebul said to him, ah, you're seeing shadows on the mountains. They only look like men. It's the sun. It's the shadows. And you can kind of sense that there enough doubt would be created that Gaal would hesitate. And so Gaal spoke again and he said, no, see? There are people coming down from the center of the land, and another company is coming from the diviner's terebinth tree, from the other direction where this tree is located. And so there's this little thing going on. And you can tell that Zebul is kind of really trying to pull his chain here a little bit. Verse 38. Then Zebul said to him, yeah, okay, where's your big mouth now? The one when everybody was drunk and you were spouting off against Abimelech? Now you see that these really are people. He kind of lets the cat out of the bag. Where's your big mouth now with which you said, who is Abimelech that we should serve him? Are not these the people whom you despised, all those shadows that are coming down in the mountain? They're the ones that you stirred up. They're the ones that you were talking against. So go out now, if you will, and fight with them. Go ahead, put your money where your mouth is. Interesting, huh? How everything gets turned around on us sometimes. You can talk big when everybody's drunk, but what about now? Go fight if you think you can. So Gaal went out, leading the men of Shechem, and he fought with Abimelech. He did it. And Abimelech chased him, and he fled from him, and many fell wounded to the very entrance of the gate. We saw the pictures of where that gate was. So Gaal fled back into the city in an attempt to escape from Abimelech. Verse 41, then Abimelech dwelt at Arumah, and Zebul drove out Gaal and his brothers so that they would not dwell in Shechem. So again, Abimelech had his ally, Zebul, inside the city, and so they were being frustrated from both directions. And it came about on the next day that the people went out into the field, and they told Abimelech. And so he took his people, divided them into three companies this time, and lay in wait in the field. And he looked, and there were the people coming out of the city, and he rose against them and attacked them. So this is a little bit reminiscent of what had happened earlier. And then Abimelech and the company that was with him rushed forward and stood at the entrance of the gate of the city, and the other two companies rushed upon all who were in the fields and killed them. So they cut off the retreat, and in a pincer movement, killed everybody who'd come out of the city. So Abimelech fought against the city all that day, and he took the city, and he killed the people who were in it, and he demolished the city, and he sowed it with salt. He leveled it. Amazing. This is the city that had made him king. And now 2 years later, he comes back and he destroys the city that made him king. Another irony in this story. Favor is a fleeting thing, isn't it? It's one of the lessons of Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. We read that. Verse 46. Now when all the men of that of the tower of Shechem had heard that, they entered the stronghold of the temple of the god Berith. Remember the picture? One with the 17-foot thick walls? That was their last fortified place of refuge. And it was told Abimelech that all the men of the tower of Shechem were gathered together, verse 47. It's interesting, isn't it, that where is the strong place that they seek for refuge? The tabernacle or the dwelling place of their god, Baal? Will Baal Berith be able to protect them? And then Abimelech went up to Mount Zalmon, he and all the people who were with him. And Abimelech took an axe in his hand, and he cut down a bough from the trees, and he took it and he laid it on his shoulder. And then he said to the people who were with him, "What you've seen me do, make haste, do as I have done." So they went to a forested hillside, and he says to everybody, "Get your axe out and get as big a chunk of firewood as you can on your back and follow me." So each of the people likewise cut down his own bough and followed Abimelech and put them against the stronghold, and they set the stronghold on fire above them so that all the people of the Tower of Shechem died, about 1,000 men and women. So this town, or this this hill, it's called Mount Zalmon here, is possibly, some feel, Mount Ebal by another name. It means shady, or lots of trees were there. So it's a logical place where they could have gotten the firewood to accomplish this, and it was nearby. Others think that it was the southern mountain, Mount Gerizim, that was mentioned. But they put the tower to the torch, burned it. It would have been like an oven inside. 17-foot thick rock walls that would have, when they got hot, just radiated the heat. It would have cooked them inside. And 1,000 people that had taken refuge there all died. Verse 50. Then Abimelech went to Thebes, and he encamped against Thebes and took it. But there was a strong tower in the city, and all the men and women, all the people of the city, fled there and shut themselves in. And then they went up to the top of the tower. And so Abimelech came as far as the tower and fought against it. And he drew near the door of the tower to burn it with fire. He was going to do the same thing again there. But as he did, verse 53, a certain woman dropped an upper millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his skull. The worst ignominy for a man of war is to die at the hands of a woman. And here he was, this ignominious man, who had led all of this and became the king of Israel, and he died at the hands of a woman who threw a millstone off the wall and killed him. Amazing, you know, how God will turn things around. Then he called quickly to the young man, his armor-bearer, and said to him, "Draw your sword and kill me, lest men say of me that a woman killed him." And so his young man thrust him through, and he died. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man to his place. And thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers. And all the evil of the men of Shechem, God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. So Abimelech meets his end ignominiously, as is appropriate. Jotham, interestingly, does not attempt to seek the opportunity to rule. That speaks a lot, I think, about that young man. Here he was. Everybody else that was a contender was eliminated. It would have been, in the human sense, an easy thing for Jotham to do. But he didn't take advantage of that, quote, opportunity. Maybe it was a test of Jotham. We don't always know what's a test and what isn't in our lives. But this was a test, it seems, that Jotham passed in terms of a test of his character. And it seems very much that just like the parable that he gave, he was content to do what he did without desire for power or for vainglory. And he walked in his father's example of not becoming king. We should be walking in our father's example and in the example of our elder brother Jesus Christ, like Jotham did. It's a good example for us to follow, to trust God and to look to God. He is, God is, our king and our leader. So I want to, chapter 10 is quick and easy to get through, and finish up the story here, so let's get through it. After Abimelech, chapter 10, verse 1, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. You know, all you can say is, aren't you glad you live in this day and age today? There's no way that you can pronounce those names any way and make it sound good. It's either Dodo or it's something else. And you don't want to be the son of either. He was a man of Issachar. What do we know about Tola, this individual? Tola means worm. And Dodo actually means beloved. So interesting, isn't it? But he was a man who rose up after Abimelech and was a judge in Israel. We really don't know a lot about him. He dwelt in Shemir in the mountains of Ephraim. That's about it. So maybe with names like that, that's about all you want to know about him. I don't know. But he judged Israel for 23 years. And he died and was buried in Shemir. And then after him arose Yair, a Gileadite, and he judged Israel for 22 years. Yair means one giving light or one who enlightens. So that's a nicer name anyway. I wouldn't mind that one as much. But he judged Israel for 22 years, and guess what? That's all we know about him too. So some of these men, their names are recorded, the length of their judgeship, and that's about it. He had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, so that's an indication that his family was pretty well-to-do. They also had 30 towns, which are called Havoth Yair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Havoth means towns of Yair. So this was an upper-class individual. They had money. They had reputation. This whole territory was kind of named for or known of them. And Jair died, and he was buried in Kamon. And then the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, no wonder. And they served the Baals and the Ashtaroths, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the people of Ammon, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. And so the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hands of the Philistines and into the hands of the people of Ammon. The Philistines were on the west, Ammon was on the east, and here are the Israelites. They're the cream in the Oreo cookie, and they're getting squashed. From that year, they harassed and oppressed the children of Israel for 18 years, all the children of Israel who were on the other side of the Jordan in the land of the Amorites in Gilead. Moreover, the people of Ammon crossed over the Jordan to fight against Judah also, against Benjamin, and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. And the children of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against you, because we have both forsaken our God and served the Baals." This follows the repeating pattern of judges. They are delivered, they're saved, and then they fall back into idolatry, and they neglect the worship of God. So God allows captivity and hardship to come upon them, and then they repent, and then God sends a deliverer again. And then as soon as they're delivered, and the deliverer is off the scene, they go back into sinning. It's just this cycle that repeats continually throughout the book of Judges. So the Lord said to the children of Israel, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites and from the people of Ammon and from the Philistines? Also the Sidonians, don't forget them. And the Amalekites and the Maonites, they oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I delivered you from them too." God has every argument stacked against them. Do you people have such short memories? Pick a nation. Did I not deliver you from them when you cried out to me? But it seems like, again, every generation needs to learn the lesson all over again, right? But the lessons are there. We should be able to look at them, foresee the evil of going the wrong way afar off, and hide ourselves from it and avoid it. But we don't. We continually, every generation, it seems, has to learn the lesson anew. We didn't. The people of Israel had to do that throughout the period of the judges. Also, verse 12, the Sidonians and the Amalekites and the Maonites, they oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I delivered you from their hand. And yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry out to the gods which you have chosen, and let them deliver you in your time of distress. Well, did that work for the Shechemites when they went into Baal? Didn't work for them very well. And the children of Israel said to the Lord, okay, we've sinned. Do to us whatever seems best to you, only just please deliver us this day. That's what we pray. Anything you want, God, just save our skins. And so they put away the foreign gods from among them, and they served the Lord, and his soul could no longer endure the misery of Israel. Still, God's heart hurt for the people and for their misery. And then the people of Ammon gathered together and encamped in Gilead, and the children of Israel assembled together, and they encamped in Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, who is the man who will begin the fight against the people of Ammon? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. And that is a lead-in to the next story, which is the story of a very interesting individual, Jephthah, the next judge, who is a half-breed, if you will, that the people had rejected. But they are offering two things to whoever it is who rises up to lead them to throw off the problem of the people of Ammon. He will be head over the inhabitants of Gilead and judge. And the word head means the captain. Essentially, the ruler. Not a king, that's a melech, but it's almost a king. He's the civil head, the leader in that sense, and the judge. So there are actually two positions when you read this in the Hebrew that are being offered. Head and judge. And so we'll pick up the story of Jephthah in the next time, and there's some really, really fascinating insights to learn from that story, so we'll pick it up there.